go right back.
Okay, let's start again.
So, the last thing you mentioned was the bailiffs come in to try and evict some of the squatters, and they seem to be unsuccessful. Or not? Did you? Was there any instances where people were actually evicted around 1990?
It seemed as though at that time we definitely had the upper hand. That people were being housed in properties as they became empty, and support was given to them. And there were these small demonstrations outside in support of the squatters. That's my memory. I think it was only later that things started to change. Because what happened later on, and this would be in 1992-93, is that ACME would start asking people to leave. Or demanding that they leave. And sometimes they'd find them different properties, or sometimes people would leave and they'd hand them back to the Department of Transport. So ACME was placed in this position, you know, in the early days they are very much the artist's friend, but they became, the nature of their position was that they were, had to abide by the law. As sympathetic as they may be to the protest, they had to abide by the law. And the protests had got to a stage where, you know, there would be some breaking of the law. You know, in very subtle ways sometimes, covert and sometimes overt. But this whole, I remember this whole issue of, okay, so now you have to make a choice. You've been saying to everyone else, don't leave your house. If you leave your house, make sure you get a squatter in. Yeah, and then ACME comes along and says, you have to leave, you mustn't get a squatter in. You know, and then it becomes, you know, a difficult position. And various people made various decisions. Because, you know, especially if you're an artist without much money, relying on that rather than the job, you know, ACME can offer you a livelihood. You know, your principles may, you know, it's the same with any position, especially with in a lot of protests that will become a key point where difficult decisions will have to be made. And some people will leave, some people won't.
And remind me again when you left.
Well, what happened in my position, and you know, I found it difficult. I might have told you this story before, but I got offered, or rather, the three of us, me, Ruth, and Sheila, got offered another house in Grove Green Road, on the other side of the road. And this would have been in 92, I think. And we were told, you know, you must leave this as a vacant property. It's going to be handed back to the Department of Transport. This is a must, you know, without it we will not give you the new house. So there was this difficult decision to be made, because I was as involved in the protest as anyone else. So I just felt I was completely betraying the whole movement to actually do as ACME asked. And yet at the same time, I wasn't unsympathetic to ACME. And Roger was on the case. So in the end, what I did do, one of my ex-flatmates was needing a place, and he was an experienced squatter, so I just had to play innocent and say, oh, I know you told me, Roger, to not leave till the Monday morning, but, you know, I had all my stuff to carry, so I left on Sunday night. I thought it'd be okay, now I would squat the place, and look, I'm here, there's someone's in there, for fuck's sake, you know, so I had to pretend that it was nothing. And of course, Dave was in there, you know, and everyone turned up, and it was all a bit of a brouhaha in a way.
And so when you say everyone showed up, who was that?
Well, first of all, Roger turned up, and he was not pleased with me at all. And I doubt he believed me either, yeah. I hate lying, you know, and I was lying to this guy. But I just had to, you know, otherwise they'd take Mycroft Green Road. Well, maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. But, you know, although, you know, it's not as hard as me as for other people, because I had some other work and stuff. But still, you know, it's difficult. So, and then the Department of Transport guy turned up, and he was saying, oh, if someone did that to my house, I'd just go in and sort them out, yeah? You know, saying, you know, thinking I was a wimp letting some squatter in, you know, and taking the piss out of me and stuff like that. And, you know, and then he was talking to me. And then one of the crusties, as they were affectionately called, who then later took over the whole protest, saw what was going on and thought I'd betrayed the whole movement. So came and started swearing at me and saying, yeah, you know, you fucking thing, and da, 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 da. You've completely betrayed the movement. And then marched up to the door and started talking to Dave inside. And Dave whispered, no, 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 he's, you know, he hasn't betrayed, you know, this is all a plan. And then because he knew it's a plan, he was even more aggressive to me because he was play-acting, you know. So it was just all really stressful and horrible, you know. And I was completely stressed out at the end of it, you know. And I think, for me, I did the right thing. But it doesn't make things any just a nervous wreck for the next day. So that was a key point. And from then on, I was somewhat divorced from the whole thing. You know, I was moved into a place where, you know, it wasn't short life anymore.
So I think where was that?
254 Grove Green Road. Later I moved out because I had a new partner and she lived in Camberwell, and actually went to live in another short life property that then we got evicted from another 5 years down the line. So I had this long, probably about 15 years worth of short life living. I just got so used to it.
And when you were at Grove Green Road, how long was you actually there at that address?
A year or two. But that wasn't a happy time, really. Because there was a strange dynamic in Philibrook Road. In Philibrook Road, you know, I was in charge because I'd been there before everyone else. So flatmates would come in and basically they'd say, you know, this is your rent and this is your room and da 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 da. And then we got on great. But when we moved into Grove Green Road, I said, look, you know, we're now equals. So we make democratic decisions, and that's when things went really pear-shaped. So much so that I had huge argument with Ruth because she wanted the biggest room because she'd had the smallest room in the past, but she chose the biggest room, which was actually the front room where the windows were really bad, and she just, you know, the noise from the articulated lorries was really loud, and then she made a protest to Acme and stopped paying rent, and didn't tell me that she'd stopped paying rent, so Roger and Sarah would be on at me, and then it all came out. It was just terrible. Yeah, so, you know, I look back on Philibrook Road with very much rose-tinted spectacles, even though, you know, some of my flatmates were completely mad.
So when, like you said, that there were all these articulated lorries now, because the road building had actually started by then, was that 91 or 90?
Perhaps, but no, I mean, if you remember, Grove Green Road and Philibrook Road, you know, it's part of an artery, wasn't it?
Oh, right, so you're talking about the general traffic now.
Yeah, that's right. It was just, yeah, and the difference between Philibrook Road and Grove Green Road is that the Philibrook Road has, you know, had a bit of a garden and a space between there and the road, but the Grove Green Road was right on the road, and she had these louvre windows that were impossible to shut. And so it was like having an open window onto the main road right next. So it was hard, and, you know, we would have all sorts of things. But, you know, the Acme thing about you get given a property and then you have to make improvements. Ruth was not from that. She was just someone who had a regular job, you know, and didn't have time to DIY and stuff. And didn't.
So was Grove Green Road, was that an Acme place? Or was
Okay. Yeah. And we did do that up, but yeah, by then it had all gone pear-shaped.
Just to go back to Philibrook Road again, you probably had a really big garden at the back, am I right? Did you do any work on your garden?
Yeah, lots.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, from the beginning, it was an odd garden because it was divided into segments, and had a kind of enclosed, bordered by brick. So there was a segment we made into a herb garden, except all the cats shat in it all the time. It made the picking of herbs slightly less pleasant than. And then we'd have various grass areas, and then there would be we had one area that was for planting, so we'd plant broccoli and potatoes and stuff like that. Not very successfully, 'cause I'm not a great gardener. But there was this fantastic plum tree, which was the great thing about the garden. It was an old tree that produced a variety of plum that you just couldn't get on the in the greengrocers or the supermarket. It's just a fantastic thing. And its yield every year was wonderful. So I remember making plum mulligatawny soup, plum chutneys, and basically between September and December it'd just be plums. So that was the best thing about the garden.
And was it when you arrived? I mean, you mentioned like the house didn't have the fireplaces in, there was plaster work to do. Was the garden overgrown or was it basically in a good
No,
condition?
it was overgrown, so it took a long time to sort out. We had to cut it back. And I remember getting one of those lawnmowers, the push lawnmowers, and struggling with, foot-high grass with those sorts of things. It's hard. But yeah, got it under control and it was nice. Great garden to be in.
And how long do you think it took to get the garden kind of into good shape?
Not that long, really. It was a long garden, and so it took a lot of maintenance. So you let it go, and then had one flatmate, Omar, who was a fitness fanatic, and once he took a machete to the grass and actually cut the. There's this image of him macheteing the grass instead of using the lawnmower as some sort of macho exercise. We'd spare periodically, make an effort in the garden, then it'd go back to wilderness again and again. I mean, some people had great gardens. Yoshimi up the road, she was always a great gardener. It's a kitchen garden and all sorts of stuff there. Some people, did a lot with their gardens. Less so with mine.
Yeah, and were they other artists or?
Yeah, Yoshimi Kihara and Noel Taylor, who lived at 181, I think. Yeah, they were both artists. They exhibited in the Leighton Artist Group as well.
And also, I was curious that also about Kath's work because her work was located in East London, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Could you sort of say a little bit about that and, if you felt there was any influence going on, because.
Yeah, we were both very different artists and it must have influenced each other. Kath was very much a colourist and a painter whose work played around with the abstracted, not the abstract, but the abstracted, much more than mine did. But she taught me a lot about art. I was very narrow in my thinking. And she had, and when she was searching for things to paint, which she paint in her own way, she often would, she came along on the demonstrations and she did a lot of stuff on the Wapping stuff as well. Although the actual work was very different. Hers was much more expressionist than my narrative style. And before then, she started off painting images of the East End before I was interested in the East End landscape in a way that I never was. And so that blending of the East End landscape with, some kind of narrative or topical images, was in a sense her art at that time. And then after we split, she went to the Royal Academy afterwards and her work's much more abstract.
Do you think, I mean, this kind of work that you did around that time and that Kath did that was located in the area? I'm just thinking about the Whitechapel shows and so forth, because there always seemed to be a representation, I felt, of work about the East End, which you don't seem to get now, and I'm just...
Yeah. Well, you know, the figurative tradition was quite strong in the 80s, for sure, wasn't it? Galleries were interested in it, you know, it was the fashion, you know. It wasn't just the Scottish painters that were doing that sort of stuff, that was perhaps just the most overt example of it. For me, you know, the relationship between art and society was much more discussed. There were books, I think Sue Braden's famous book, Art and Society, was, you know, something that a lot of people read at the time. And community mural schemes, you know, were big, you know, the famous Cable Street murals, yeah. So that was, you know, that was influencing, I think, artistic production at the time.
I'm thinking also GLC, because the GLC funded a lot of big projects, didn't they, in the 80s? And I think that collapsed around 85, 86.
Yeah.
So I think that had a lot of influence, probably on mural and also community-based work. Had such a lot of support then, didn't they? And then that was followed up by the London Arts Board, actually.
Yeah.
So maybe, because we had the London Arts Board, didn't we, and the Arts Council.
Yeah. And there were a lot of competitions, if you remember, that, you know, were sympathetic towards figurative work, whether it be the South Bank Show or, you know, all sorts of things like that. That, you know, the rounds that artists did, almost a seasonal thing, isn't it? Mm. Expecting, you know, whether they get artist newsletter, most people did, and applied for certain shows that they felt they could, you know, have more of a chance of getting in. Yeah, a very different climate, I think.
Mm. And then also, the little watery colour shadowy images, those really delicate images, which came after your Wapping pieces, which were very strong, very bold, and in the thick of, you know, riots, basically.
Mm.
Were they done when you was in Philibrook Road? So how did they sort of come about? Can you sort of speak a little bit about them?
I don't know. No, I can say a bit more than that. I was coming to an impasse, I think, in my art. And the watercolours were a way of getting round that, or one of various methods. I think it was that in an effort to earn money, and this is something I think a lot of people did anyway, there was a government scheme called the Enterprise Allowance, and I was on it a couple of times at least. And the second time they're a bit stricter, so they wanted a business plan, and yeah, it was a bad time for me. I think it must have been about 1992, and things were difficult, so I went on this scheme and proposed that what I would do is paint nice pictures of Epping Forest College in watercolour and then sell them to the houses round about, yeah? And they thought it was a great scheme and gave me £2,000 for the year to do it. I didn't sell a single work, yeah? But wandered round the streets of Loughton sticking crappy cards through doors and sitting in pubs, you know, admiring the view. It was okay. But that was watercolour, and I think I'd thought, you know, watercolours, maybe I'll be able to sell them a bit more than these huge oil paintings of strikes. And then, because I was never trained in watercolours, I don't know what came first, these rather wishy-washy images of Epping Forest, or, you know, these kind of strange things that came out of describing you know, a Philibrook Road community that seemed to be on the verge of extinction. And so I'd paint these, you know, these very watery images of houses disappearing into paper and ghost-like figures, semi-transparent in front of them, that seemed also ephemeral and about to disappear. And then from that, I don't know where this notion of burning came from, but I started burning the things, because that, I mean, there wasn't, I don't think there was ever a house that burnt down, but just, you know, it seemed symbolic of destruction, and that's what was happening during that later time. I think there was, I think the first big thing that happened in Philibrook Road, there was a huge warehouse, I've forgotten the name of the company, but it advertised genuine antique reproduction furniture, which always seemed a bit of a contradiction in terms. Anyway, that got knocked down. And suddenly, you know, all this effort to save houses and standing outside and getting people, suddenly this huge area of Philibrook Road was just knocked down, and it wasn't, it was, you know, it was a tipping point as well. Then the sorting office, obviously the posties got got sent somewhere else to another sorting office, that came down as well. Suddenly it became like a demolition site, and you realised, you know, that's, you know, this is going to be really hard now. And that's about, you know, when people, you know, people started getting noticed just to quit, you know, and it got really serious, and you had to, you know, so there was all that destruction, and that came out in these odd little watercolours, which also was able to do them next to the gas fire in the living room and in the kitchen area. I think money was tight at the time, and I only had Caligas heater in my studio. And that had always run out, and I'd have to wait a week for them to order the next canister. So I used to put crappy pop stations on and kind of dance while I painted to keep warm, and, you know, lots of layers and stuff like that. So to sit next to a gas fire and do nice little watercolours, you know, it was great. You know, especially there was one winter, I think, then that was really cold. So a mixture of reasons why it's difficult to think now.
Because they've got, you know, little haunted faces. And, I mean, what was the mood like at that time when people were actually getting these eviction notices? And did they actually evict people? We're still like 1990, aren't we?
So. Yeah. I mean, I took a lot of photographs with disposable cameras at the time. And they were of these congregations, especially outside the sorting office when that was under threat. But also, you know, houses and stuff. And then I painted from memory and from these photographs. And the paintings that came out seemed to express a mood that wasn't there then, but would be soon, you know, this sense of being lost, of things being lost. Because the original photographs from the demonstrations didn't really express, you know, it wasn't like that. You know, we knew that it was difficult, but it was nice to, you know, to meet people before breakfast and have a chat, and then sometimes you get a cafe with some people, or, you know, invite friends around for breakfast, and, you know, community and adversity. Yeah, similar in a way to the print strike. You know, there was a great sense of community down there, and it was kind of echoed in a smaller way in Philibrook Road and the surrounding streets.
And when you moved out of Philibrook Road into Grove Green Road, when exactly did they demolish Philibrook Road? Was you there at the time in Grove Green Road? Because that guy, Dave, he was squatting your old place, wasn't
Yeah,
he?
And then, the thing is, his mum or dad died quite soon after it, so suddenly he was just gone overnight. Yeah, he had to go, his dad died. So he had to go up to Birmingham where his mum was, and, you know, spent the next few months there. So he wasn't able to sort anything out, and then I think he got repossessed soon afterwards and stuff like that. And, I don't know how quickly it got knocked down. I think it got boarded up. And then they had to get the Connollys out, who were this, you know, the construction family next door. They actually went. It was funny, when we moved in, the youngest son, he must have been about 12, 13. And by the time I'd left, he'd got a job in the city at St. Barclays Bank. And he actually bought a place the other side of the tracks, you know, towards Leytonstone High Road. So when the family got moved out, because they kept seeing him in the street, he actually put his family up, you know, because they were homeless, because they fought to the bitter end, and Mr. Connolly was not a man of compromise at all.
Were they homeowners? Or?
Yeah, they were homeowners.
Right.
Yeah.
So did you know if they got any compensation?
No, I know it was just really hard. And I think he, you know, his health suffered a bit from it, as often happens, I think. She was a ferocious woman as well, but, you know, I was very fond of all of them. But I think, you know, and I think the son did a good job looking after the family, but it was interesting to see that whole circle take place. Mm. Yeah, but I think they were the last to go from that part of Fillybrook Road, yeah, because they were surrounded by Acme, I think. So Cornelia Parker was on the other side, and Nick Deverson, I think they were in, yeah. And then the quadrant houses that, you know, were there, they got evicted as well. But it was the case, the students in quadrant houses tended to be students who studied subjects that were more likely to get employment from. So it was easier for them. I know I dated one of the women, Angela, and she ended up buying a house down towards Leytonstone High Road. So, and her friend Claire, I think they bought it together, so that wasn't a problem. And there was some nurses amongst them, so they were able to move quite quickly out of it.
And that was the time of the slump, when the prices went right down, and because they were going to be near the motorway, they would have been even cheaper. So,
yeah, no, it was before the slump.
Then.
Yeah, because you know, it wasn't that easy. You know, I remember they bought houses, but they didn't buy them. The slump came afterwards. The slump came after Black Wednesday.
Okay.
So this was kind of, you know, some after, but some just before, which made it, you know, not, you know, it was all a bit of a...
So basically you're saying that, you know, you felt that probably a lot of the artists wouldn't, you know, that because of the whole practice of doing art and the difficulties of having regular income in a very different position from these students in other, leading to other professions who could
have
more chance of getting work or...
I wouldn't say different rather than very different, I'd say. I mean, we now, you know, Ian still lives in... And a lot of artists still live on those houses now, the ones that still remain. And I think much more so than you know, tenants from Quadrant who, you know, it's seen as a stepping stone in your early 20s. You know, you've got a job that doesn't pay some, and then you settle down and find a partner and buy a house and that whole sorts of process. You know, that happened to them much more regularly than... It did with artists, although some artists, for sure, you know, for various reasons, money that family has or success or job, would buy, you know, small houses off Grove Green Road, you know, towards Leighton. I know Julian and Perry and Sally did, and Linda and whatever, Robin did as well. So a number of people were able to do that, I think.
And I remember some of the houses being offered. Some of the Acme houses that weren't going to be demolished after all got offered to the artists.
That's right.
Quite cheaply.
Yeah.
And a lot of people took them up.
Yeah. I don't know how many, but
no. An
amount, certainly. I mean, Ian's the only one I know who's still there. I think there are some others. And there's another woman, another Sally, who lives in Grove Green Road, went to a party. Yeah, so there's some still there, for sure.
And Gary Doherty.
Ah.
Who never actually lived there at the time, did he? He lived in Plaster.
Oh, really?
But was always in the Northcote pub.
Okay.
And I always thought he was an Acme artist. And another guy who... was a teacher in Grove Green Road. He got offered his place, but I can't remember his name at all.
No, yeah. Yeah, things started to fragment, didn't they, in various ways. It's interesting how that happens, I think.
Yeah. And so, tell me a bit more about your last couple of years in the area. How did things continue? I mean, you've mentioned these attempted evictions and people protesting or trying to stop them. Were there any other things that stand out in your mind?
Well, about that time, there was, you know, I think I was around 30, I turned 31, and I was still earning like £4,000 or £5,000 a year, you know, just bits of money. So a minor crisis occurred where I thought, you know, I've got to make a change in some way. I never enjoyed teaching art, because mine was narrative painting, and to teach still life and stuff, you know. You know, it's not as if I'm going to do a picture of the whooping dispute and stick some oranges and lemons in the corner. So it's completely irrelevant to me to teach that sort of art. Life drawing was okay, but it's a bit boring, you know. I think by accident, friend of a friend, I got offered a job teaching A-level art history. And just spent one summer swatting up for the September course that was given, you know, just because no one else was around to teach it. And that was great. And just got so enthused by that. And I think, you know, because I had to do, you know, I had to learn so much in a short period of time. I just, you know, it was a nice summer. I just lay in the garden, lay on my bed and just read books and books. So about that time, I started to withdraw from activity. And a number of people, you know, like with a hard teaching job or anything, you know, you do your stint of a number of years and then you get burnt out or something else comes up, etc. So I remember that, and then I needed a qualification to continue teaching what I was finding really enjoyable. So I applied to get the Courtauld Institute and got in. And this was all at the same time as, you know, this crisis in my creative practice. You know, I paint these nice watercolours of, you know, wasted individuals, you know, hanging around on Philly Brook Road with burnt houses. And people look and go, oh, that's nice. Why didn't you exhibit in the library? And I thought, you know, what's the point, you know? It's fine. So that was the tipping point, you know, and so I thought it was a waste of time.
So you mean this job here, basically, that you're doing now, well, teaching art history?
Not quite, but I know this was originally at Redbridge Institute, and I taught there for a number of years, and then from the Courtauld Institute got another job, then went to Birkbeck to a part-time MA, and through the part-time MA at Birkbeck got a job as a kind of organiser for arts at the WEA. So, oh, you know, it worked out for me.
Okay. Did you say WEA?
This is the, yeah, Workers' Educational Association.
Okay. So, in a way, it all fits in with your kind of social, political kind of interest in a way, that you're kind of actually doing something really constructive here.
Yeah.
And I can see why the art history really suits you, because while we're doing this interview, I'm sort of really conscious of the fact that everything that was going on when you lived in that area, that you was looking at, like your paintings about Wapping,
yeah,
and the setting up of the open studios, and then the poll tax riots, and all these things that have become quite intertwined really around that period. I mean, what that kind of like brings me on to, I suppose, the issue of that particular time, and the fact that, you know, there was a lot of artists living down there, probably about 150 houses. And do you think there's a possibility of ever something like that happening again on that scale, or do you think it was very particular?
I think it'll happen again, but differently. I mean, it's interesting working here in Hoxton, yeah, Because, you know, the amount of artists, you know, in this square mile is phenomenal, the amount of galleries. If you go out on a Thursday night, you trip over private views. But it's a very different feel. It's just different, yeah. So, yeah, things always happen, but the next time they happen, it'll have a different twist to it, I think.
What do you think was different about then?
Well, I think all sorts of things. I don't think there's just one thing. You know, it'd be wrong to say it was a more political time then, because my perception of the time was that, you know, a lot of artists were involved politically in what was going on, protests of rights, some much more so than me. But there was hardly anyone doing political art. You know, I felt quite, you know, I think, can't think there was anyone else in the whole Rhodes, you know, whole Leytonstone that was doing political art. Yeah. So, and there's not many people doing political art now. So there's nothing different there. It's not as if there was a lot and now there isn't. There are less artists involved in campaigns now, but there aren't that many campaigns now, apart from the protest against the Iraq War, which, you know, it's not as active as it was. You know, these small things, the single-issue campaigns, seem to have disappeared, so there's less chance for artists to participate in them. The nature of artistic space has changed, for sure, because the short-life property isn't there. You know, so the artists living in this area, you know, maybe, you know, the maker artists have to be richer in order to survive. I don't know. You know, I mean, but then that's a case of London, isn't it? You know, to buy a one-bedroom flat in London now, anywhere, never mind this area, it's hard. You need some sort of help, whether it's mummy or daddy or some sort of. It's difficult, isn't it? I don't think I could afford to buy now. So all sorts of things contribute to, yeah? It's like the makeup of people in universities. I mean, people go to universities to study and rather than learn for learn's sake. You know, because they have all this debt and stuff like that. So it's a complex situation. And I think, you know, artistic communities in any one time will reflect all these complexities.
Because when you look back and you think about your house that Philibert wrote, that you did up on the cheap, I mean, the inside in the garden, I bet it looked really nice, because I can remember going in some of those houses. Mm. Have you ever lived in anywhere...
This is a good question,
like
yeah.
that since?
No, I will never live in a house as big as that again. Totally not, yeah. I mean, I live in Crystal Palace now, and I have a one-bedroom flat, and the house... You know, it's one of those old Victorian high ceiling houses, great, because I'm tall. You know, but I've just got a couple of rooms in the house, but this was the whole house. Mm. And I can't, now I'll never be able to afford anything as big as that.
And when you were living there as well, I didn't ask you, but you mentioned plastering, but did you have any major repairs, like ongoing things, like a leaky roof or anything? Because they were sort of quite symptomatic, weren't they? Yeah. Short life housing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit, you know, because the lodger stayed in the room with the leaky roof above. So it was my job to crawl up every week and empty the bucket that was above their ceiling. Yeah, and if I'd forget for a couple of days, you know, I'd wake up in the middle like, oh my God, you know, poor lodger paying money and there's this bucket full of water lying above their bed. And once, you know, on a particular heavy night, you know, there was a knock on my bedroom door, 4 o'clock in the morning, Steve, my room's flooded, so I had to go out. Yeah, so I think it was the case with all, you know, people in Philibert Road who let rooms out and stuff like that. It was a lot of make-down land. Yeah, and my cellar was flooded, we had a pump in there. Yeah.
Oh, yes, because Roger Kite was saying that quite frequently cellars would get flooded and... One had eels in it because it used to be a river.
Yeah, I don't think it was mine, but yeah, I remember that story as well. And it was someone round about, yeah. Yeah, it was the Philly Brook, yeah, that ran underneath our houses.
So when you left, was that 92, did you say? Completely the area?
No, I would. think I left the area completely around 95.
Oh, okay. So you stayed...
in Grove Green Road for a couple of years, yeah.
Right. So talk me through, like, we kind of got up to about 1992, kind of the build-up the last 2 years, because you would have been there when the other campaign emerged.
That's right. So, you know, the period 1993-94, I was studying at the Courtauld and I was subsidising my education through various part-time jobs here and there. So I was completely exhausted that year. So I wasn't involved in any activity whatsoever. But I would, you know, still go to the local pub. I mean, I was dating someone and she lived in South London, so half the time I was in South London, half the time. So, you know, I was gradually losing my... connection to the area, but you know, still saw what was going on and it was around us, and there was some tension between the old guard and the new protesters, because there were two different cultures, you know. A lot of the ACME artists, you know, had settled down in a way that, you know, the crusties, you know, they were living an alternative lifestyle. And there were, you know, all-night parties, and I went to them, and they were great, yeah? But if you were someone, you know, in your mid-30s who'd, you know, got an ACME house 10 years ago and just wanted to go to bed at 11 o'clock after whatever, then, yeah, it wasn't. And, you know, lots of bad things went on as well, lead stolen from roofs and stuff like that.
Was that, do you think, to do with the... Dot rather than
the
Department of Transport rather than the protesters, or do you think?
I don't know. I think that there were. They were instances, and I don't know how many there were. But you know, I think as the new group of protesters moved in, and everything became much more high profile. You know, as the heat came down, it really did. Because when we were protesting, it was all quite genteel. You know. You know, the idea that 15 people could stand in front of a house and then that house was saved for another year. I mean, you know, nothing was really done. It was, compared to what happened later, quite genteel. Yeah, just as valuable, I think. But, you know, nothing like the tree houses and all that sort of thing, the very high profile. You know, and the second group did a great job, I think, you know, and
so
then it carried on.
Can you remember, like, when they sort of came into the area? Like... did they come as a huge group, or was it kind of gradual, or...
I'm not really the person to ask, because it happened much more in Claremont Road. That's where it really changed. And I remember going to parties in Claremont Road, and the whole street, I think, you know, was transformed, you know, and they knocked walls down, so, you know, like in that Beatles film where, you know, there's the whole terrace but it's all one house, you got that sense of a warren and just a complete alternative community. And it did happen much less in Philibrook Road, you know, it's, you know, so that's where everything really, so you'd need to talk to people who lived in that area to get a better sense of it.
So when you were there, it was the time when they had the art house. And the little cafe.
But I only vaguely remember those. You know, I went down there, like, you know, hardly ever, and it was usually on a Saturday night when I'd spent 3 hours in the Northcote first anyway, so my memory is completely hazy about that. You know, I always had a great time and stuff, but yeah, I couldn't really say anything about it.
So when you mentioned tree houses, could you sort of elaborate on that?
Yeah, not really. I mean, I saw them and they were there and...
Where were they?
Claremont Road, I think so. Yeah, I know there was some up near Wanstead as well, or so I believe. There was the whole thing about the oak trees in Wanstead. But again, this was stuff I wasn't having first-hand experience of. And you know, I think it was odd. Something that you're very much a part of, you extricate yourself from it for various reasons, and then... you know, a whole new group of people take it over. It's a straight, you know, you become a bit of a tourist whenever you walk down in it. And you're not, and to come back to this idea of groups and clubs, you know, you're definitely not a member anymore. You know, it's sympathetic, a fellow traveller perhaps. But the baton has been taken over, whatever analogy you want to use, anyway. So it's like a cycle had taken place in a way. And so towards the end, problems with the house in Grove Green Road. But that as well meant that I just Leytonstone didn't feel my home anymore. So it made sense to move out.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of mentioned, like in a way, the artist, and then the protesters who came and lived on Claremont Road, and the sort of idea of the old guard. I don't know if you spoke to the local people, got a sense of how they might have felt if they felt there were separate groups or if they didn't distinguish. Because I wonder if they kind of viewed the artist as like, oh, the artist, you know, like, we'd, because there were a lot of us artists, we kind of would say the local resident. So in a sense, we're making this division. And then with the road, anti-road campaigners, we make a sort of division again. I just wondered if you got a sense, because when you was in Philibrook Road, you spoke to a lot of people in the street. Although at that time you said you was kind of, when you were in Grove Green Road, you were moving slowly away. Did you get any sense of maybe what the local people were thinking as opposed to artists?
Not really, no. I mean, I knew my neighbours in Grove Green Road, but I think by then, you know, a lot of stuff had come down. You know, the battle had been lost by then.
Really?
I think so. It was very much, I think Claremont Borough by then was, you know, almost a rearguard action, yeah? To hold things up as much as possible, but you got the sense it was going to come through by then, I think. It's interesting, if you're involved in various campaigns, there is what's called the tipping point, isn't there? People debate whether it's this or that. I think, you know, as I said before, the thing for me is, you know, when buildings started coming down, you thought, you know, well, you know, carry on. But, yeah.
So when you were there, can you give me an idea of the scale as to what had actually come down?
Yeah, well, yeah, if you imagine Philibrook Road divided into two, so there's domestic house, and we're just talking about the right-hand side of Philibrook Road, because on the other side, nothing was knocked down. Yeah. So it's interesting, on the right-hand side of Philibrook Road, as you walk up from the tube and away from the tube, you know, there'd be a mixture of artists and non-artists housing, but they were all kind of certainly lumped together by the people on the other side of the street as all kind of similar, you know. It was a division of street, one side and the other side, completely.
Because one half was Short Life.
Yeah.
And the other half was the side that was going to stay.
Yeah, that's right. Because I had, when I taught art and life drawing in Epping Forest College, some of my students lived on the other side of the street, so it was odd going, you know, to say hello and crossing the street. I remember once crossing the street and knocking on the door and feeling, wow, this is a different world, yeah. I never walked down that side of the street before, no point. You know, and the street, very busy with cars, so it was almost like a border.
Right, so Philibrook Road was the first to go then, was it?
No, I'm not saying that. But to come back to what I'm saying, that if you take one side of Philibrook Road on the right, there was a, you know, at one end there was residential, at the other end there was residential. In the middle there was the sorting office and then this warehouse. Yeah. So when those went, and this is my memory, I'm not sure, then suddenly the whole landscape transformed. And, you know, rather than being a set of buildings that, you know, we're preserving, you know, suddenly there was this huge hole, yeah? And, you know, perhaps in hindsight, you know, that's when you realised that, you know, time was running out.
And around that time, did you ever go down Dyer's Hall Road?
Yeah.
What was going on down there? Was there, like, demolition going on?
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult to put all this into any sort of chronology looking back on it.
Mm.
Very difficult to put it into a chronology. But, you know, all around that time, especially it was in Grove Green Road, because you can cut through Dyer's Hall Road, that sort of thing. You know, there would be demolition going on, I think. And then, you know, residences, you know, became more pocketed in a sense rather than being a row, you know. Because there wasn't one long terrace, there were groups of terrace blocks, weren't there? You know, so once they got everyone out from one block, then that whole block went down, and then suddenly, you know, the morale sunk and, you know, it hit hard, I think. Yeah, people, you know, some people found it very difficult.
Mm.
Mm.
So, with that, then I suppose streets would have got cordoned off at that time.
Don't know about cordoned off, but sections of houses, I think, got cordoned off.
So, when they were like, knocking down one side of the street, would they have put hoardings up in front of the houses?
No.
Or was it open?
Open, I think. As far as I remember, yeah. So you see the bulldozers, you know, and dust. And, yeah. Maybe there was hoardings. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Guards, security guards.
And then Colville Road, I mean, what do you know what happened down there?
It's all a bit hazy as well.
Yeah, I'm sure. So was it actually Claremont Road was the last street, because that's where all the protesters were?
Actually, I think that was the focus of attention, because that's where the protesters were.
Mm.
I don't know, you know, I don't know whether, you know, that Connolly's in Philibrook were one of the last to go or whatever. I know they were one of them. I don't know how chronologically the eviction of the last in Philibrook marries in with the whole struggling. You know, that was certainly, for Claremont was certainly the high profile focus at that time.
And what I wanted to ask you as well is, I suppose you've talked now about the change of the area. I mean, just thinking back to, I mean, you've talked about the post office going, which is a huge kind of building, and there were like little corner shops and so forth, wasn't there? I mean, how the kind of area is changed, I guess, then.
Mm.
And the whole loss of the community. And I'm just thinking really about, I mean, if you put the whole thing together, really, the place, and your involvement socially and your artwork. And we've talked about what you're doing now, which is in art history teaching, but in a very particular organisation. And I just thought it would be quite interesting for you to talk about the show that you did recently in Leytonstone.
Mm. Yeah.
Because that does really fit in, doesn't it? And yeah, how that came about and so forth.
Yeah, that was interesting because I was in this band, The Mosquitoes, and they, three of us, we all lived in Philibrook Road, practiced in each other's studios and stuff like that. And then for various reasons, I left after a couple of years. And then John and Noel played together for 6 months, a year, and then they split. But we've all kept in touch since. And Noel's been wanting to form a band for a while, and then a friend of a friend moved to Leytonstone, and I put him in touch with Noel. And I was never intending to start playing the drums again. And they said, oh, I was writing poetry at the time, and Noel said, oh, come along, maybe you can read some poems out and stuff like that. And I was much more into that, but as soon as I turned up, there was just this drum kit there, and all thoughts of poetry went out the window. And playing the drums can be a delightful thing to do, and I just suddenly found how delightful it was. And not that I'd missed it, but... So we started practicing in this place called the 491 Gallery, which is one of the last buildings left from that whole time. That's not a house, really. It's been squatted, and there's some recognition from the council. And they struggle along, you know, put exhibitions on and gigs and stuff like that, and have this recording studio, and that's where why I ended it back in Leytonstone once a week, because we just practice in this recording studio. And then, you know, just got to say hello to people in the 491 Gallery, and just the idea of perhaps having an exhibition there, because, I mean, my artwork is very low-key, because I do this job here, it's 4.5 days a week, and I do teaching as well, so, you know, I have time to do little bits and bobs of art, but not to promote myself. So if I can stumble across somewhere that'll have an exhibition of my work, that much effort, you know, I will take it. And so I did. And, you know, the venues like that, there's quite a lot of work to actually get it arranged. It's, you know, that was interesting in itself, and to invite people along that were part of that whole time. And, you know, certainly the Mosquitoes have played lots of house parties and stuff during the heyday of the of Leytonstone and the artistic community there. And I think, you know, we're looked on reasonably fondly, you know. So it was just a nice thing to do, to play again. And the exhibition, you know, was good for me. And I have kind of thought, is my practice anything to do with, you know, the experience of what went on? And directly, I don't think it is at all. You know, it's interesting, though, that my final watercolours before I gave up or stopped in 92 had burn marks on, you know, I burnt them. And my whole practice now is about burning food stained paper plates. So there must be some connection at some level, some picking up where I left off in some way. You know, and if you live in short life accommodation for 15 years, it's probably going to affect some kind of connections in your brain. And so maybe, you know, the idea of a paper plate and the temporariness of that sort of thing may well link into, you know, that past. And perhaps because, you know, when I burn and stain the paper plates, I don't want to make them ugly. I want to make them beautiful, but in my type of beautiful way. In the same way as I do look back with rose-tinted spectacles on that time in Leytonstone, as, you know, there was chaos and da-da-da, but, you know, it was great.
Because also when you was in Philibrook Road, and presumably you had a room so you could play your drums.
Yeah.
Did you have that in Grove Green Road? Or was that was more like one room per person, wasn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't as big in Grove Green Road, so yeah. Yeah, I had a big studio in Leytonstone in Philibrook Road, and the drum kit was in there, and then we'd practice in there, and I'd paint in there, and it was, yeah, it was just, yeah, it was like kind of a teenager's dream in a sense, you know, you have your big room that you can do all your own stuff in.
And then just a little bit more about those watercolour pieces that you displayed, because you, the show was called What a Waste, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you placed it quite firmly within that time.
Hmm.
And those water, and there was medication or something on the plates, wasn't there? Something. What was, how do you
see that?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things, when I studied art history at Coulthard and at the at Birkbeck, I was never going to be an art historian. I teach art history at A-level or first-year degrees, fine, but yet to actually be a researcher was never for me. But if there was any research, it was to research art enough to find a way back to it.
Yeah.
I kind of found that. So what I'd do is I'd teach 20th century art movements every year. So every year I'd go back to surrealism, back to abstract expression, back to minimalism, you know, back to these movements. And in a way to rethink lots of things. And, you know, one idea that, you know, that I've been playing around with a lot is this, you know, the idea of the controlled and the uncontrolled. You know, that you control, you can control some things, but you can't control others. You know, a bit like, okay, you can control, you can delay the road, but it's probably going to come. Yeah, it's probably out of your control. There's always a slight chance you can stop it, but probably not. And that's always been kind of my philosophy. It's definitely worth doing all this thing, but there's always going to be some things out of your control. So when I burn and stain paper plates, you know, there is that, that there was always that balance between, you know, the accidents and the thing that's done on purpose. And with the tablets as well, I like the idea that there's a mess and a stain on the paper plate, and then the tablets are fixed in some sort of constellation of shapes. And tablets are a way to control, you know, albeit a problematic way of controlling. So I think there's that, but perhaps more than anything, it's just at the moment I make, because my studio is my kitchen, so I just make art from whatever I find in the kitchen. You know, and there's food, and there's red wine in the bottle of red wine bottles, and there's paracetamol tablets when I drink too much red wine when I'm doing the art. So, you know, it wasn't a conscious decision to kind of juxtapose this symbol of control on this mess of red wine stains or stuff. It just happened, and then afterwards thought, oh, it actually quite works quite well. Let's push it a bit further. So
I'm just thinking of them making a connection with Acme, really, and their whole philosophy of, like, giving artists space and the freedom to work, and how, in a way, we all kind of were recycling as well and using whatever was around. Like, even when you talked about your fireplaces, that you used the boards that were on the windows to kind of...
I think that's a good point, actually, because I think one of the things I did think, and one of the reasons I moved on to, you know, taking 6x4 snaps and making art with food, is that, you know, I felt oil paints, what's that, you know, it's nothing to do with everyday life. It's nothing to do with engaging, you know, on a material level with everyday life. But, you know, to get something that you would also eat of, and then splash a liquid that you also drink onto it, and then see the beauty of that, just as you may appreciate the beauty of its taste. That kind of made sense in a way, that you make, do and mend a short life property.
I'm just